Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with REM's radio song to introduce this week's show. At the beginning of 2011, President Obama signed into law the Local Community Radio Act that allows for the biggest expansion of community radio stations in U.S. history. The Local Community Radio Act allows low-power, neighborhood-based stations to broadcast in urban areas for the first time. It also marks the first major legislative success for the growing movement for a more democratic media system in the U.S., and it represents power shifting to grassroots groups and media advocates and invites policymakers to join forces to overcome corporate opposition to media diversity. We talk with Vanessa Graber, Community Radio Director at the Prometheus Radio Project, about low-power radio, and we'll learn more about the Local Community Radio Act. The Prometheus Radio Project was founded in 1998 by activists working within social change movements such as housing, environmentalism, healthcare, anti-war, and criminal justice reform. These groups found that their success was limited by corporations' ownership and control of the media, who use their power to suppress debate on vital issues. Welcome, Vanessa Graber.
Thank you. My pleasure. And I'm really excited to talk about the Local Community Radio Act today.
At this point, my community, which is actually an island community in the San Francisco Bay, where we do have lots of other radio stations, both public and corporate. Let's talk about the Community Radio Act and then also, of course, how this would affect communities like ours.
Well, the Local Community Radio Act was recently passed and signed into law by President Obama several weeks ago. So we're really excited that the law passed after a 10-year battle with Congress to get this in place. Now, what this legislation mandates is the FCC to expand the low-power radio program. The last time the FCC issued licenses for low-power radio licenses was back in 2000. And they give the license out primarily to rural areas. There's about 860-some licenses that were available. Since then, they haven't given out any more licenses for low-power radio. So this law mandates them to expand the program and open up the application process.
And is it significant that Obama is the president? It sounds like the 10-year battle started at the beginning of the Bush administration. Does that have anything to do with this?
Well, it's not so much the administration that really stopped this bill from passing. A lot of it had to do with, corporate interests represented by the National Association of Broadcasters that really put a damper on this bill passing in the House of Representatives and the Senate. Luckily, with all the advocacy and public participation that we had from people all across the country, we were able to overcome his corporate interests and get bipartisan support for this bill.
So you said 860 licenses originally. So that's the number that we're working with here, or is it a larger number now?
We hope that by expanding this program, we'll have anywhere from 1,000 to 2,000 new licenses available.
Besides the Prometheus Radio Project, are there other groups like yours that are trying to promote low-power radio?
Absolutely. We have friends out in Davis, California called Common Frequency. They're another small nonprofit media organization. They work with a lot of existing community radio stations, and they're our partners in a lot of this LPFM outreach. We're also working with groups like Future of Music, who represent independent artists, musicians, Free Press, which is a large media policy organization based out of Washington, Reclaim the Media out of the Northwest, and several other, I would say, advocacy groups that are interested in letting people know that this opportunity exists.
So it sounds like the time has really come for this, and people around the country are very excited about what they can do in their communities.
Absolutely. We're seeing a lot of increased media consolidation across the country. We're seeing the eradication of a lot of community newspapers and local TV stations and radio stations being bought out by large companies. The loss of a lot of jobs for people in those industries. To that end, that makes it very hard to get local news coverage, to get representation from groups that otherwise would have access to the media, like minorities and other social movements. And also very little participation from community members who are just interested in preserving local history, art, and culture.
We're talking from a progressive point of view, but I would imagine that there's also a lot of groups that are pushing for their own stations, their own radio, that are less progressive, that have more restrictive points of view that they would like to promote too.
Well, these radio licenses are very valuable for that reason, and that's why we're hoping to inform lots of people to make sure these licenses get in the right hands of people. The reason I say that is because back in 2000, when these licenses were originally awarded, more than half, a little over 600 of the 860-some licenses were awarded to religious networks. Now, there's nothing wrong with religious programming or even churches having the licenses. Some of them are truly community-based and serve the constituents in the area. However, the bad news is a lot of these religious networks pipe in programming from satellite and don't actually have any volunteers or people from the community working at the stations. To that end, we don't think that that is representative of a community radio station, and we think the license would be better used by groups that are actually from these small cities and towns that will be able to represent the viewpoints of the people in the area.
For a town like ours, as I mentioned, I'm in Alameda, California, which the area is represented by a lot of different radio stations. Would it make sense for us? We would love to have our own little low-power station, but would it make sense? We have about 75,000 people here.
Absolutely, and that's actually ideal for LPFM. We've seen LPFM licenses in communities much smaller than that, that maybe only broadcast a couple miles an area. And it's really good, especially if you're on an island, for emergency alert system purposes. Let people know if there's a storm or flooding or power outages. It's also just good to have diversity of voices. You know, even though there's lots of stations, I'm positive that there are still groups that don't have access or representation to the media in your area. And every new station that crops up will allow those opportunities for people to get on the air.
We also formerly had a huge naval base on our island, and it actually was part of a landfill area that the naval base was on. And that is now a Superfund site. It's no longer a naval base, but it's been turned back over to the city. And this is a very big deal in our city because there's a lot of toxic contamination, and there's also a lot of misinformation about what that contamination is. And this kind of issue would be perfect for a low-power radio, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And actually, in Vieques, Puerto Rico, there is a very similar situation. There was a lot of bombing and advocacy done against the bombing in Puerto Rico in the late 90s and early 2000s. And a group that was very interested in stopping the bombing and getting involved in the environmental protection of the land was able to get the military to leave and close Roosevelt Roads, which is a naval base. Now that very same group is launching their own community radio station. It will be a full power station. In addition to starting the station, they are also exploring the same things that you're talking about, which are how can we restore the lands and address all of the environmental issues that are impacting the health of the residents. So working on those two fronts by doing grassroots organizing around that and using radio to inform people makes a really, really great use of the radio station.
I mean, we do have, for example, when we do our city council meetings, the city council has those videoed and they go onto a local website. But we're not talking about internet radio here. Let's distinguish the two.
That's correct. We are talking about an actual radio station that broadcasts, you know, on the spectrum that you would receive via radio. Now, it's true that many of these LPFMs, in order to extend their signal, also broadcast online. But what happens is, during emergency situations and bad weather, and when there's power outages, if you recall in the Gulf Coast, a lot of TV stations and, you know, a lot of power outages prevented people from accessing information. And in fact, there was one low-power FM radio station in Mississippi that was able to give people the information they needed during that time because people had access to battery-operated radios.
So, Vanessa Graber, what does it take for a community that, again, we're all suffering with the economic downturn here, with money has been taken away from cities and states? What kind of numbers are we talking about? What are the steps that we make to create a small radio station?
It costs anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000 to get your station up and running. However, you don't have to come up with all that money at once.
Now, that's the actual facility, or that's just the license, or what does the license itself cost?
The license itself is free, non-commercial educational license. So unlike commercial licenses, which are bought and sold, these are given for free by the FCC. Now, the money that I am talking about is money to pay for equipment, mm-hmm. like a transmitter, a antenna, tower, studio space, all the infrastructure that you need to get the station up and running. And like I said, you don't need that all at once. So I'll talk about the process of how to get a license, and then you can understand where the costs come in. Right now, you cannot apply for a license yet. The FCC is going to have a rulemaking, so they'll be able to make sense out of the legislation and interpret it in such a way that they can set up a system to accept applications. Once that happens and the FCC sets the rules for the new LPFM stations, communities like yours will be able to commission engineering studies to see if there's a frequency available. Now, if there is a frequency available for LPFM, what you'll be able to do is start your paperwork involving, the expertise of maybe an engineer and a lawyer and maybe the folks at Prometheus. And then you will have yourself ready for when the FCC opens up the window. We expect that to happen anywhere from 6 to 18 months from now. Our best guess is that it'll happen early 2012, which is approximately a year from now. So once you get your paperwork in for the application, the FCC then will award licenses to communities where there's no competition. So say that you have all the criteria, the requirements set forth by the FCC, nobody else is competing for the license, they go ahead and award those first. Then they award the groups competing against each other in a separate process where they award points to different applications. Now, if you are designated to be the license holder, you are awarded what is called a construction permit. That's a temporary license, and it gives you 3 years to get your station up and running. And during that time is when you will start fundraising and getting money together to pay to get the station up and running, and that's when you will start to pay the $10,000 to $50,000. Now, you have 3 years to get your station up and running. Some stations do it in less time, depending on what they have available. And after the station's up and running, depending on whether or not you have paid staff running the station, most LPFMs don't, mostly volunteer run, it costs anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000 yearly to sustain the station. So that's the process that we have ahead of us. It's definitely lengthy, anywhere from 2 to 3 or 4 years, but if you're dedicated to bringing local community radio to your community, it's a really worthwhile investment.
And is there any obligation to have programming 24 hours a day?
No, there isn't. There might be some changes to the rules when the FCC does the rulemaking. I believe the only requirement is that you have like 12 hours a week of live programming.
12 hours a week. Oh, that's very doable.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of stations go off the air at midnight.
Yeah, sure. So if you maybe do a morning show during morning commute drive time for 1 hour and do evening news for 1 hour, you will have already covered your...
And what else should we know as a community? Again, in our particular case here, which may be a little unusual in that we're an island, there's no restrictions because there's shipping and so forth going on around here. There's no restrictions around that?
The only restrictions are, like, what frequencies are currently available that would be interfering with, you know, the existing stations. And so it's harder for communities like you to find available spaces on the spectrum.
I see.
But hopefully we can influence the rulemaking so that the FCC can be really flexible and that we can find these frequencies for communities like yours.
What else should we know?
I would recommend that you involve as many people as possible in this project. We've seen in the past that applicants with really strong ties to the community and have a collaboration of groups working with them are the most successful stations. They're most likely to get licensed, and also they're most likely to stay on the air and be able to fundraise effectively.
Mm-hmm.
We hate for these licenses to go to groups that aren't able to stay on the air because they're not able to sustain programming and volunteers and fundraise. It takes a lot of people, time, and effort to run these stations to their full potential. And so by organizing people now and getting lots of folks involved, the better your chances are of having a really, truly community station.
One of the things that I can imagine happening, and especially in a town like ours where there's a mix of voices, there's progressive and then there's more conservative and then there's, you know, people that have been involved in the military, that there would be ideological differences. And, of course, the idea is that you get as many of these different kinds of voices out there so that there's this quote-unquote fair and balanced. How does Prometheus suggest communities that have a diverse range of voices facilitate that kind of programming?
Indeed, it is the most difficult thing to really negotiate on, who gets what time on the air and how much. I think it's good to bring people to the table, find ways that they can find common ground, find people that are willing to, you know, negotiate. That's not always going to happen. There are some groups that are going to want to hold the license for themselves and represent a particular viewpoint. Unfortunately, when that happens, you will have to compete against them, and the best person hopefully will win.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's always good to make the invitation, you know, to extend a hand and see if people can collaborate. That always won't be the case. If not, then, you know, it's just better to work with people who, you know, are able to sustain the station and work well as a group. You know, working in station support, I do get calls from people that are in need of conflict resolution. The board's not getting along with the volunteers or the programmers. And so that's something to keep in mind going forward. Will you be able to work with these groups or these people in the long run? I don't think it's appropriate to invite people to participate with you for the sake of having many different voices represented. We really have to consider these people as partners, as staff, and to be able to make the relationship work in the long run.
And actually, you just brought up another issue for me here, which was you mentioned a board. So this is a 501c3 or some sort of nonprofit or a fiscally sponsored organization that has to have a board.
Yes, that is correct. Now, you don't have to be a 501c3 in order to apply for the license. You do have to be a state-registered nonprofit. Each state has different rules for what that means. But in general, it means you have to be a group that's incorporated with a board.
Okay.
Now, there's several different models for this as far as applying. Ideally, your nonprofit will already be in existence, and you will be the same group that operates the station and holds the license. Now, that's not always the case. Sometimes there are groups that are not incorporated, not nonprofits, but they are dedicated to running the station and making it work. Oftentimes, they partner with a 501c3 or a nonprofit organization. The organization will hold the license, but then they will, you know, delegate to the other group to actually run the station.
What about promotion? The PSAs and those sorts of things are not what I'm talking about here. But what about if somebody at the local grocery store has a special going on, something this week, and they want to do a little promotion for their store? I mean, that, of course, would enhance the community spirit and people getting involved in the radio station. But is that advertising?
Well, there's several different ways that you can, you know, work with local businesses and organizations to promote them on the air. Now, there are very specific rules around this that the FCC has set forth, and there are rules on what is called underwriting. So as a non-commercial educational station, LPFMs are not allowed to have advertising, but they're allowed to have sponsors. You see this a lot on PBS, where they have programming brought by their local sponsor. So that type of thing is allowed. You're allowed to use your website to place ads and, you know, promotions from your sponsors. You're allowed to mention them on air. They're allowed to contribute items to be raffled off or giveaways. you just can't promote it in the same way that commercial stations do in the form of advertising.
Okay.
But you certainly can have them be sponsors and, you know, be mentioned on air in brief ways.
And then we can also do on-air fundraising a la Pacifica and those kinds of radio stations.
That's correct, yeah. They're called membership drives or fund drives. And people can go on the air and ask their community members to give donations to the radio station.
Now, let me remind our listeners, we're talking with Vanessa Graber, Community Radio Director at the Prometheus Radio Project. Can you tell us a couple of stories about really successful projects that have come out of Prometheus?
Sure. And if you go to our website at www.prometheusradio.org, we have a whole page on our barn raising. And though we have many, many success stories from stations all across the country, our barn raisings are really the best stations that we think represent community radio. And for folks that don't know, Prometheus is located in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and in the outskirts of Philadelphia, we have a really large Amish community. And the Amish, in the past, when they had raised barns or constructed them, they involved all the members of the community, and they do this in a day or a couple of days, and it's truly a collaborative effort. To that same spirit, we've coined the term radio barn raisings, where we recruit people from all over the country, and especially from the community that the radio station is being held, and, you know, they come together and they build the station in a weekend. And the way that we've selected those stations is through our strong relationship and also through our application process where, you know, we get folks to tell us why they're the best folks to have a barn raising. So the last one we did was in Hudson, New York. We did that at the end of September last year with a station called WGXC. They're a really awesome station. They are different from some of the other stations that we worked at in the sense that they're a full-powered station, and also that they have a strong connection to the arts, transmission arts in particular. But they represent a wide variety of people in the community, especially artists, filmmakers, musicians, and a lot of progressive viewpoints and minorities. We're really excited to bring a full-power station like theirs to the community. We've also worked with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Immokalee, Florida. And they are tomato pickers or farm workers, and they have used their station to organize around labor rights and to get better wages and working conditions for their workers. And so that's a great example of using radio as a tool for social justice. There's also a station in Davis, California, KDRT, also known as KDRT. They've been on the air for a really long time. They have a history of providing really a progressive voice to the area. We're really proud of them. There is Picoon. They're in the Northwest. They represent the farm workers of the Northwest. They're another immigrant community. They've used the station to provide Spanish language programming to the farm workers and really educate them, again, around immigrant rights and, you know, to preserve the culture and history of the people in the area that have been there for a really long time.
That's a really good set of diverse voices that you've mentioned there. Thank you for doing that. I think it helps people understand just the variety of what is going on out there with the low-power radio. Prometheus Radio Project came about in order to respond to corporate ownership of the media. Let's talk a little bit about that direction now. As someone embedded in radio, have you seen it become even tighter, the corporate control? Recently, I'm talking about.
We have. In the last 10 years, we've seen a huge amount of media consolidation, not just in radio, but in all forms of media. My past background is that I worked for Clear Channel, which is one of these big media giants that we've been working against, ironically. But what I've seen at Clear Channel is a system where they buy up stations and they lay off or they fire a lot of the staff and they keep only a couple people, mostly salespeople and maybe one or two board operators, and they pipe in all the programming through satellite, and there is little diversity in what they're playing, even from city to city. So you are hearing these carbon copy stations that sound the same. You know, for instance, I drove up the East Coast from Florida up to New York, and, you know, there were at least seven stations that had the same exact format, same music, same radio personalities, same news, and they're all owned by Clear Channel. So we've seen that as a trend. We've also seen a lot of stations having financial problems because of the economy, not having as much access to foundation or government grant money that was available before. So it's making it hard for them to find new ways to fund themselves. And then also, we've seen a lot of emphasis on the internet lately, where, you know, a lot of these stations have moved some of their content to social networking sites and blogs and other websites where, you know, they're able to attract a new audience. But those are some of the things that we're seeing. There's definitely still a large corporate influence over news content. We have very little access to international news. You see that now with, you know, not being able to access news sites like Al Jazeera for the stuff going on in Egypt and so forth. And so those are all trends we're tracking. We work really closely with other media organizations in Washington that do a lot more policy around issues like net neutrality and corporate mergers like Verizon and Google and the NTT Universal merger. So we're definitely paying attention to those issues and seeing how they relate to radio in particular.
Because radio has definitely made a huge comeback, hasn't it? With the rise of the internet, it seemed to be a little bit as though it might be heading in the opposite direction, I suppose I'm saying, and that just has not been the case at all.
Well, they said when TV came about that radio wouldn't be around for a long time, and we saw that that wasn't true. And when the internet came about, they said that radio was surely done, and we have also seen that not to be true. I think the trick for a lot of these radio stations is to exist in a variety of different platforms, to work closely with their counterparts in community access TV, to use social networking sites like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube to also, like, distribute their message and use podcasts to send to people directly to their email, to promote their shows via text message, and just to really integrate themselves in the wider spectrum of media makers that exist right now. I think in the past, radio sort of existed in a vacuum, and now we're seeing them exist as one of the many types of media that are available to get the message out there.
What about training people to be on radio? And you might want someone who doesn't really have any idea of how to be on radio, and then there's getting air cleared. Are these issues that we would have to look at?
Absolutely, and that's why I think it's really good to look into working with existing stations that are already knowledgeable in those things. There's a lot of retired engineers and radio programmers floating around that would be super excited to get involved in these new projects. There's also people that are really awesome that work for NPR and Pacifica stations that would be willing to volunteer to work with other stations. And then looking at the existing LPFMs that are out there as mentors, as people to look for as experts in order to provide advice on these issues. Of course, there's lots of national conferences that provide training, like the Allied Media Conference, the Conference on Media Reform, the National Conference for the Federation of Community Broadcasters, and so forth. So there's lots of opportunities to meet people, network, get trained. And there's also a lot of websites where you can link onto listservs where you can ask these kind of questions and find resources.
Vanessa Graber, Community Radio Director at the Prometheus Radio Project. Are there any things that you would like to share that I haven't covered?
Sure. I just really want to tell people to look to our website. We have a lot of training materials and information, much more in detail than what I've shared with you on the air. The resources are all free or open to anybody that wants to use them. Unlike some other membership organizations where you require a membership and a password, Prometheus provides all its educational materials free. So I encourage people to go to our website, www.prometheusradio.org. Also, if people are interested in staying up to date about the FCC process and when the rulemaking is going to occur and to stay up to date on the application window, you can register for our newsletter that comes out monthly called The Broadcast.
Vanessa Graber of PrometheusRadio.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.